lake or a pool. Instead, it's kind of dispersed in bubbles through the shale layers, the fractured rock deep underneath the earth. And the technique has been developed to actually send water with chemicals in it into the earth under pressure to break that rock a little bit more and let the gas escape and come up and be captured. That's been done for a while here in New York State in what's called vertical fracturing, where the well goes just straight down or at a slight angle. But the new wrinkle is to add in a horizontal component where the drill corridor goes down over a mile or more and then goes horizontally for that distance. And more water under high pressure with more chemicals is used to break apart a larger area of rock and let the gas come back up.
So, Kathy, just from an empirical idea that I have is that wouldn't it be better if we drilled further, deeper down into the earth as opposed, than to drill vertically and potentially contaminate our aquifers with both gas and the unknown components of this liquid that we're using to fracture the earth?
Right. That's intuitively, you would think that a shallow drilling might be more dangerous because we have shallow surface waters. And if you could get deep enough, then you would basically isolate whatever this process is. And the industry claims that that's what happens. The difficulty is that even several miles down, if you set off explosions underground, if there are already fault lines, you may trigger earthquakes, and we've seen that in some regions. And even very far down where you think you might be able to trap these chemicals and isolate them, there are already fractures in the rock. And when you do more high-pressure fracturing, you potentially create pathways for these chemicals to connect with, if not the immediate surface water, then perhaps distant surface water. Mm. In addition, there are gases released during this process. The methane itself, which is natural gas, which we're trying to capture, is itself a very potent greenhouse gas. And if it's not all captured at the wellhead, or if it's released as you're trying to transport it, then that has potential health effects as well. So the process was developed to try to obtain gas that would otherwise not be available, and the idea is to try to do it in a safe way. I'm just not certain at all that we've achieved that yet. In fact, I'm pretty certain that we have not mm-hmm. achieved it. The DEC is trying to put in place regulations that would make this a safe activity, and I think it's the duty of all the environmental groups that are active in this, and the opportunity is there for any citizen to participate in that and give feedback on whether or not the precautions that have been developed, the regulations and the scheme work is sufficient to allow this activity to start to take place on a large scale.
Have you seen people coming more citizens coming to you and other environmental groups? Are you seeing some questioning or?
Absolutely. Okay. The DEC conducted 4 public hearings. They were very well attended. The public spoke, I think, in a very articulate way, generally very strongly in opposition to this activity beginning under the current framework. And the DEC is also taking comments from their website and written comments by mail up until, as you said, the January 11th cutoff date. So part of what I'm really grateful for the invitation here, I think part of what the public needs to do is become well-informed and then give feedback on whether or not this is something that they want happening in New York State and in their particular community.
Now, if you're someone like myself who, really has a fear of writing, and I wouldn't even begin to know how to maybe, or I would, but I mean, thankfully, because I've been doing shows like this, but I think, the average person, it's hard to articulate why they're against hydrofracking, to put it down in some kind of list, so it's not just an emotional response. How would the average person who's listening to this right now immediately act on the information? Would they go to, like, let's say, Catskill Mountain Keeper website, get a bullet list of what they need to know?
Yes, the Catskill Mountain website, Mountain Keeper website, and other websites have lists of what some of the problems are. I think supporting those organizations that do articulate your views for you is helpful. Talking to the people that you know and encouraging them to take action is good. It doesn't have to be a very detailed comment. I think if my concerns about the health effects here are for the water and the air mm-hmm. and the soil. Mm-hmm. And if somebody says to the DEC, I don't want you to take an action that's risky to my water supply, that's very straightforward. I don't think this is a good idea for you to do that. It could be as simple a comment as that to begin to have the agency, and we also encourage people to direct their comments directly to Governor Cuomo, to have the administration know that the public is very wary about this.
Okay. In the next couple of minutes that we have before Buck Moorhead calls in from NYH2O, that might be him. But anyway, I would like you, Kathy, if possible, to talk a little bit about the effects of first of all, what are the chemicals, if any, or if we even know, because there's a, I forget the word for it, when an industry has a special formulation and they don't have to share it.
Proprietary formula.
First of all, how is that proprietary formula regulated? What are those chemicals used? Why are they using chemicals? And what are those particular effects on children and pregnant women?
Mm-hmm. The chemicals that are used by the industry in general, we do know some of the corporations have disclosed that, and we have some information, and they include some pretty terrible agents, benzene, toluene, a whole bunch of polyaromatic hydrocarbons that have multi-syllable names, surfactants, and a host of chemicals that are allowed, that are designed to keep these fractures open and keep things from growing in the fractured vein so that the gas can come out. So they're biocidal. They're intended to keep organisms from growing.
See, I didn't know that.
Hundreds of chemicals. And many of these are carcinogens. They're known carcinogens. They are teratogens, that is, they cause birth defects if you give them in a laboratory setting. And the industry talks about them as being either in very small quantities or being able to be contained, not flowing away from the site where they inject them. The difficulty is that many of them are toxic in parts per thousand, parts per million, some even in parts per billion. And my firm conviction, having looked at the evidence, is that they cannot be safely contained in the site where they originally start. In addition, once this material is gone underground and it comes back up, it brings back up with it heavy metals and radioactive materials.
Right.
So in this fluid, you have an even more toxic brew once the activity is completed, and we currently have no safe place to dispose of that. So there are harmful health effects for people who live close to the site, and there are potentially harmful health effects for anybody who is exposed to those chemicals in their water supply or through the waste products being brought to their community and not handled properly. It's really a toxic brew that I feel is not yet, we haven't worked out a way to keep it where it started out. And the industry has no responsibility under the current regulatory framework to handle its own waste products in a responsible way or to take care of anybody who is injured by their activity. The industry has received exemptions from the Superfund cleanup laws, as well as from the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Air Act.
Exemptions, you said?
Exemptions, so that if another industry creates a toxic spill and is proved to have done that, they can be held accountable to clean it up and restore that area. This industry is exempt from that. So even if they do create the problems that I think are likely to come, and we are able to prove that, they would not be able to be held liable under our current regulatory framework.
Well, that right there is tremendous. I mean, that they would just push that through. Is that because we're so desperate to get natural gas?
These exemptions came during the Bush-Cheney era, and that was the argument, that we needed this so desperately that we should be willing to take it even under these terrible circumstances where it might cause harms that would not be repaired.
So
that is itself a questionable claim, because the gas natural gas that's being harvested currently in this country is largely being sold to be shipped overseas. So it's not even being used for domestic purposes at present.
Okay, so I want this to be very clear to folks out there. That number one, that if the industry does have a situation where there's a contamination, someone is injured, they are exempt from legal liability, one, right? And two, that the gas that we're harvesting through hydrofracking, the majority of it is actually being sent overseas. So someone's making a profit, probably the industry. But we certainly are not, and we will be left holding the bag if there's something goes wrong, if there's a mess. Kathy, we have Buck Moorhead on the phone, but before we go to Buck, hang in there. I just want to get right to the effects of these toxins, these chemicals. First of all, what amounts does it take to create a teratogenic occurrence? And again, when you said teratogenic, you're talking about an alteration or damage to a fetus or a child or in utero. And can you talk about what you've seen? Is there any research of where in areas where there's already been hydrofracking of teratogenic effects?
We're starting to encourage that research that, as far as I know, it hasn't been done, it hasn't been published yet, and it's difficult to do. Our health departments are under enormous stress, and the beginning research that I've seen, people are trying to find information, and the information is not being collected rigorously enough to allow us to tell when there are birth defects that might be seen in the community. But we do know from laboratory studies that even very tiny amounts of these chemicals can harm the developing fetus. They cause the cells to mutate, and developing cells need to be normal, mm-hmm. proceeding normally, not mutating. This can be in very small amounts, and what happens with the hydrofracking site is you have a plume underground, and the closer you are to that site, the more hazard there is for you. But many of these materials can, as I said, cause difficulties in very tiny parts per million or parts per billion concentrations. And when the fluid is brought back out and taken to a waste handling site, it's actually concentrated, material there. And if that waste site is not well contained and has any leaks or spillages into an aquifer, I think the danger is quite real. It's not that at every site you will see every problem, but you will see a lot of problems when you start to do this on large scale, because it adds up. In addition to the reproductive problems that we talked about and potential carcinogenic properties, there's also the air pollution that was not contained at the site and can go to any nearby community. And many communities in New York State already have very difficult situations in regard to air pollution. So we have sites across New York State where we have Superfund cleanup already taking place, or we have air pollution, and we're talking about potentially bringing in an industry to add to those bad situations.
And the air pollution is both the release of methane that you mentioned earlier, and also the use of diesel trucks, I understand, or diesel generators?
Yes, the compressor stations for the transport of the fuel in pipelines all are diesel-powered at present, and they release those toxins. And the trucks, the truck traffic is also really a health hazard, because there will be more accidents when there's more large vehicles on the roads, especially in communities with small, narrow roads. Mm.
So yeah, it's a whole list of and I don't think we've even touched all of it yet. But on that note, let me bring in Buck Moorhead. Let me see if we can. Buck, can you hear us?
Oh yes, I've been thoroughly enjoying this conversation the last couple minutes. I always learn something when Cassie's talking.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us on Tell It Like It Is. And again, if people are just tuning in, we've been speaking with Kathy Nolan, Regional Director of the Catskill Mountain Keeper, Woodstock. And in studio is also
Dylan Hirschgutz.
Thank you. And also Fran Martina, who will be speaking later about sports fish and contaminants and that. Buck is a co-founder of NYH2O, and he is joining us by phone from New York City. Thanks again, Buck, for joining us this morning. Can you, first of all, tell us a little bit about NYH2O and how it was founded?
Yes. Thank you very much for having me, first of all, Christina. I'm an architect, actually, in the city, and I have been working for a number of years in the Upper Delaware region, which splits New York and Pennsylvania. And about 4 years ago, I was at a meeting of the Upper Delaware River Roundtable, which I participate with, regarding land use issues. And actually, Wes Gillingham, Kathy's colleague from Catskill Mountain Keeper, talked about Marcellus Shale, and I had never heard that term before. This was in the fall of 2007. And back in that at that time, it was like in the, particularly in Pennsylvania, northern Wayne County, it was like if you saw the movie There Will Be Blood with the landowners, the guys going around in station wagons trying to sign up people for oil leases. Well, that was the sense in Pennsylvania at that point in time. It was very mysterious. People didn't know what was going on. And it was confusing. I mean, very confusing at that time in the sense of total helplessness, because the first, you know, understanding was we could do nothing about this. So I came into it. I'm not an environmentalist or even an activist, or, you know, not until this point in time, but I came in as a neutral. But by 2008, up there was Damascus Citizens Group formed in out of the Wayne County, Pennsylvania area, which has been a very active organization. They showed a video up there about it. There were a lot of red flags. They sent a videographer out to Hickory, Pennsylvania, where they were drilling, and he came back with something. Josh Fox has property up in the same area as well. He saw that video and became interested and had been offered a lease on his family's property. So by late 2008 and into 2009, I ended up with several people, including a couple members of Damascus Citizens, co-founding NYH2O in the city. And its mission, even though it's based in the city, was to protect the, look for a ban on hydraulic fracturing throughout New York State, not just city-based. So that was has always been our particular mission. And we started out back in, for about a year and a half back then, going around to New York City has 59 community boards, and we went to about 48 or 50 of them and got bans, them to issue resolutions banning hydraulic fracturing throughout New York State, which was, you know, just educating, and people had not heard anything about it back then in New York City. So that's kind of the way that New York NYH2O formed.
NYH2O, I know part of the mission is to protect, and you can tell us, how many millions of people in New York City depend on upstate New York for their drinking water?
Well, upstate New York is providing about 90% of the water to New York City. It's also providing it to other communities, you know, in the Hudson River Valley as well, but and Westchester, but it's about 90% of the water comes through the Catskill Delaware system, and the balance is through the Croton Reservoir. So it's you know, eight million people, or I'd say plus minus. But the Delaware River Basin itself is about 15 to 16 million people, because that drinking water is going down to Philadelphia, Trenton, Camden, that whole region.
And maybe Kathy can say something a little bit about this, or you can. Is this that the quality of water that comes from from this area, this unique area, and unusually pristine water. Can you comment on that?
Oh, Kathy, I don't know if you want to go first, it's an amazing water.
It's one of the largest, if not the largest, unfiltered water system in the world, and it's wonderful water. It's amazing to me that we would even consider an activity that would threaten it.
Yeah, it was formed, the area was of the Delaware River Basin was glaciated way back when, and when it receded, it left a very gravelly geology, and because the upper Delaware is 90% forested, which is also a natural filter, it's stunning. It's probably some of the best water in the world.
Buck, maybe you can talk about issue of demographics and the issue of jobs, because traveling through Western New York, upstate New York never really experienced any of the boom cycles that New York City experienced, and I think that folks may come out and say, well, I understand this, but I've got this property, I've got this land, agriculture is not as viable as it used to be, although that's a whole nother issue. And people are, as you said, people come from the industry and they build this up as, a possible way to make some money, and people say, well, sure, why not? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Definitely. That in the upper Delaware, that's in sitting in meetings, and I've facilitated meetings as a neutral between landowner groups and the industry and some of the organizations that are would be termed as anti-drilling, and listening to this a lot, and it's a very difficult and painful situation in towns where folks have been offered money and leased their property and have large enough parcels where they can make a sum of money from it, and then listening to their neighbors who may be sitting on a one-acre piece of land or in a small hamlet, and they're going to get all of the negative impacts from this activity and risks to their water and their air and health and the such, and they're not making a cent from it. And it's extremely difficult. I mean, that question of private property rights with respect to what one can do with their property, as well as one's community property right to the right to clean air and clean water, and the what's emergent in the certainly with the New York State, we'll probably get into this, the EIS or now revised generic environmental impact study, is that they've come out with a socioeconomic study which talks about potential job growth, which would be possibly a benefit to the region's economy, but that study as it exists now is woefully inadequate. It doesn't take into account any of the lost jobs from what are some, New York has some vibrant economies going on. I learned, just recently that it has, I think, the second to California in terms of wineries, which would be absolutely would lose. I mean, they would be, who would drink a bottle of wine from New York State if it's in a region that was hydrofracked, for instance. So, and tourism and hunting and fishing and recreation, agriculture and the such. So that part hasn't been accounted for, and I've just in the last day or two, Joseph Martens from DEC they've asked the consultant on that study to expand portions of that study because there's been so much pushback about its inadequacy. So I think that the economics in general is a bit of a Trojan horse, the way that it's represented. The reserves that were accounted for in this New York State study have been reduced by 80% by USGS, so there's a tremendous misrepresentation about actually how much shale gas there is. So, it's a complex issue, and it's pitted neighbor against neighbor, and certainly in the upper Delaware, and I think throughout the southern tier of New York, where you have large landowners who can benefit enormous amounts, but it turns out they're quite, a small percentage of the actual population as well in the southern tier.
And again, Kathy spoke earlier about exemptions, the industry being exempted from any recourse. So let's say if anybody's seen Josh Fox's Gasland, if you consented to allow drilling on your land, and then, you know, a month or maybe even a year later, you turn on your water tap and you find that you'll never be able to drink your water again.
Well, let me clarify that
sure.
The exemptions that the industry has are from certain federal regulations. The individual still would have the ability to try to sue the company if there were that individual situation.
Okay.
It's just that to have an individual suing the gas industry is
right.
A David and Goliath situation. And what has happened around the country is in those situations, the industry typically will provide some kind of relief to the family and then get a non-disclosure agreement so that the people who have been harmed cannot even talk about the fact that they've been harmed. So there is technically still a way that the individual could try to hold the company liable. It's just that in practice that won't really work. And it's partly in recognition of that our country developed the Superfund laws and so forth so that there's a government that can come in when multiple people have been injured and it would be hard for any of them to obtain relief from the industry. So this industry is now basically is asking for New York State to give it permits on a generic level so that they can do this in multiple sites around the state without having that responsibility on the other end if they do cause a problem. And part of their argument is that they provide enough benefit in jobs and through provision of this energy source. But as Buck is saying, in terms of the jobs, it's not that clear that they would be here for New York citizens without causing other people to lose their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the energy sources, maybe Buck can speak to this, the need for natural gas to me has been very much a product of the industry's advertising rather than a real need.
Yeah, I can add actually to the job question in general. The Barnett Shale, which is in Texas, they have a longer history than most regions of the country, so they've actually been able to go in and actually look at some of these issues, like what's really in fact been the case when the industry has a longer term shale drilling experience. And they tested, looked at 9,100 out of 15,000 wells that were drilled in the Barnett Shale in Texas, and found that if you looked at that relative to what were normal protocols for determining whether the activity was economic or not, they found that 94% of the wells, of those 9,100, were uneconomic. In other words, they weren't paying off. They didn't have a 30-year lifespan. They might have a year or two where they're productive, and then they fall off. So there's a large amount of uneconomic wells just from a drilling standpoint. And they also found out when they went into Dallas, into the city of Fort Worth, where they've been drilling, they tested those sites and found that over 90% of the sites were contaminated with carcinogenic chemicals from the activity, including benzene and so what is emerging from that is that there's a tremendous amount of environmental degradation by drillers who go and they go from one well to another site, most of which are busts, and they're contaminating the environment as they go along, and one wonders why do you do this. And the price of gas right now, I think, is about $4 a unit.
Mm-hmm.
And it, apparently, to be economic, it needs to be at $5 a unit. And one wonders why is it this proceeding and the such. And what's known now is that these companies that hold these leases and do the drilling, they've sold large percentages of interest in leases to international energy companies. And there is, at this point in the Asian market, the price for gas is indexed to the oil market. So it's where it's $4 here, it would be $12 to $15 in China. And so that which is economic to the industry if they can ship it over to Asia. So there is a sense certainly now that there's a pressure to put a new pipeline into Manhattan at the moment, the Spectre pipeline. There is pressure to create export terminals, of which we've typically only had import terminals in this country. Under eminent domain, now there's a movement to make export terminals so that we could have a situation where we have developed shale gas, developed a whole network of pipelines, and if you listen to T. Boone Pickens, we'll have the Nat Gas Act, which is a federal act in Congress now that's under consideration, which would develop all these commercial transit vehicles that will convert our entire country to natural gas, and then be competing for this resource with worldwide markets. And so it won't be, this idea of a cheap, domestic, energy-independent deal personally think we're just being, it's a huge scam that is being put upon us.
So, maybe I can tie this together with I did Google NYH2O and I saw I think a representative speaking at an Occupy Wall Street rally, the connection is which you just made it sounds like another corporation creating a boondoggle where they're making the money, they're shipping the gas out, and we're going to be left the taxpayer. Maybe not bailing out a bank this time, but maybe creating a super fund to clean up a mess that was left behind. Is that simplifying it a bit, Buck?
We have so much, our country is so large, and we have so many resources and so much land, that we treat it disrespectfully historically. And you look at France, banned in France. I mean, but Europeans are, they're much, every square meter of land in Europe they care about and try to take care of. I mean, I'm sure they screw it up as well at various times, but it's treated in a different way than we have. I mean, I just learned today that we have invested, the federal government has invested $24 billion in support of fossil fuel research between 1978 and 2007. The federal government has been working in partnership with the gas industry through subsidies and research dollars to try to make this shale gas work. And so the federal government has wanted to happen, and now we're knowing more and more about it, obviously. So it's not that it's just the gas industry alone. Unfortunately, it's been at the federal level, and you can imagine if we had taken $24 billion and thrown it at alternative fuels back starting, after Jimmy Carter there. But that changed, in the 1980 with Ronald Reagan, and it changed because we've been subsidizing, we've been underpaying for oil since the 70s with the price freeze that Nixon created when he froze prices.
You talked about the history, Buck, and it reminds me that just a little over 100 years ago we created the Catskill Park and the Adirondack Park, and it was because the early settlers had come in and overused the resources. They cut off all the trees, they did the tanning right next to the rivers and ran the chemicals into the rivers. And here in New York State we have the birth of the environmental movement because of industries pouring their waste products directly into the Hudson River. And what we did in those circumstances was try to correct the harms that these people had done. And in this case, it seems to me that we have the potential of doing a much less expensive and morally more desirable route of preventing that harm when we have every reason to expect that the harm will come with this particular activity. Why would we allow it to go forward and go forward in an intensive way? So I think we have the opportunity to influence our government here in New York State, learn from the experiences of these other states, and learn from our own history, and some of that fairly recent history, to prevent our going down a path that's going to cause us these harms. Then we have to find the people who have been harmed and try to treat them in expensive medical treatments, and we have to go through expensive cleanup of areas, or worst case scenario, not be able to clean up. How do you restore an aquifer mm-hmm. once it's contaminated? You have to use water to dilute contaminants. And if you don't have the fresh water or clear water to use, or if the toxins are toxic at such tiny amounts, you may not be able to actually clean up an area if you allow it to be trashed along the way.
I just want to remind people that we're, this is Tell It Like It Is. My name's Christina Malisoff, and in studio we have, who is just speaking, Kathy Nolan, Regional Director of Catskill Mountain Keeper, and on the phone from New York City, Buck Moorhead, co-founder of NYH2O. There's so much to cover, and we have had programs a number of times before on this show, and people can go to the archives, or they can go directly to the websites of the two organizations we just mentioned, or there's a number of other organizations which hopefully we'll mention at the end of the program, because there's a whole issue of chemicals. I even heard someone talk about using some of these leftover chemicals as de-icer on roads, and I found that absolutely horrifying. But what I'd like to get to in the next couple of minutes if what is the strategy? Because I'm convinced, but what I'm not convinced of is the power that we have as citizens in New York State, number one, to stop the fracking, if not stop it completely, how to regulate it properly, the oversight that's needed when the DEC has already been gutted, because of our state budget. And the other question is what is the strategy for replacing this drive, this inflated idea that we need natural gas? What can we replace that with? What should we tell people? What's our green energy plan, our green job plan? So it's a big one to bite off. I'll start off with you, Buck.
Okay. I'll address the first question about the, what do we do with respect to trying to stop or regulate this? I had heard when I was listening to the last couple minutes before I jumped on of your conversation. I agree with Kathy that this, our conclusion and that of many is that this simply cannot be regulated. It's an intrinsically unsafe activity. If you can look at simply two items about it. One is well casing failure. The industry has never figured this out yet, how to make well casings work, and they 6% fail immediately, 6% well casing failure, and within a couple years you've got 10 or 12%, and within 3 years 20%, and within 20 years it's like 50 or 60% of the well casings have failed, and they can't for a number of reasons, but what happens in many cases is that they can't seal the joint between the actual casing itself and the earth that you're drilling through. If you can imagine, you're drilling down, you've got dirt and rocks and the such, and that's a very uneven surface, and you're trying to make a pure, perfect seal between that and your casing pipe. It just is not happening, and doesn't happen. And so that, by itself, it means that they're going to be leaks and cross connections between lower levels where these, the 80% that stays down there is and kind of migrating up. The other part of it is that the geology, and this is speaking specifically to New York State, it's right now, it has existing fractures that the DEC in its present draft is absolutely in denial about. And it's fascinating because they use there's a guy, Jacoby, who did a report in 2002. I guess he must have been a geologist. They cite a lot of work from him in 2002. But there's a map of existing fractures in New York State that is in the EIS right now, in this revised draft, that is from the 70s, and it looks like a blank piece of paper. It shows no existing fractures in the geology. But Jacoby, the same guy they have in other parts of the study, in 2002, he has a map of fractures, which is like a spider's web all through the southern tier, like very fractured geology. So the idea that this is never going to migrate is not is just simply not true, and there are a lot of studies that have cited that. So that makes it intrinsically unsafe. And to the point of accidents, there were accidents and spills, and I read something just today again in the Niger Delta. There was a major accident off the coast where they're drilling. I've heard the rate of like 2 to 8% of well sites, have accidents or spills. And if someone, say a couple of years ago said, listen, what if you just said 1%? If there's a 1% accident rate, it's like saying, if who would fly on a plane if there was a 1% rate that the plane would crash, or your car?
Right.
I mean, that's a very high risk to take, with what we're talking about. So I don't think, and then there are a slew of other reasons, about staffing and such, why this is difficult to regulate and should be banned. So how do you do that? I mean, I think that this, in our state, Governor Cuomo, this is in his hands. I think that he's been pushing this pretty aggressively. Mm. He wasn't before he got into office, but after he got in, it became clear that he wanted this to move forward swiftly. And now it's like every other day there's a new study or new information that points to problems, and specifically the EPA. The most recent federal study was EPA in Wyoming, which is the first federal study that's made a direct connection between fracking and the pollution of groundwater, water supplies. And so I think he's in a very difficult position, but I think any pressure that can be borne, I think it's going to fall on his shoulders. It's got to be directly to him in New York State to push for a ban. And it's really just a question of whether there's a ban before anything goes wrong or after. I mean, something's going to go wrong, no question, and then it would be banned. So there will be a ban eventually, but it's the question is to get, the challenge is to get it before we have a disaster here that's equivalent to a Love Canal.
Mm.
Someone mentioned yesterday, we know he's interested in being to higher office, and he doesn't want to have that on his shoulders, that he let this happen in New York, and it was a big problem.
Good point. Kathy?
Yes, we agree. Catskill Mountain Keeper has called for a ban for exactly these reasons. We are also participating in the process of trying to make the regulations as strict as possible in case this does go forward. So on our website we have areas where you can direct comments to Governor Cuomo. You can also, a listener who wants to state their opinion on this can just use a search engine and just put in DEC fracking, and the DEC's website for taking comments on the draft supplemental generic environmental impact statement. There's a form there. And the review of these regulations takes place at a couple of levels. One is the scientific and the regulatory level, and these environmental organizations are doing that. You can support them. But I feel like it's quite valid for people to use that form or to send in a written comment that just gives their impression of what they know, even if they can't make detailed scientific or legal observations. I think it's very important for governmental leaders to know that people don't want this, and the way they know it is for people to stand up and say it. And the organizations that we work with are very happy to help you find a way to express yourself if you have a view and you want to let Governor Cuomo know, to definitely do it. And it now is the time. It's urgent that people speak up. The surveys that are being done are showing that more and more people across New York State are aware of what hydrofracking is, and the more they know about it, the less they like it. So in the most recent study that I've heard, it's now almost 50% opposed. If we take those numbers to 70 or 80% or 90% opposed, then I think our politicians will be hard-pressed to continue on, or certainly continue on at this kind of rate.
Absolutely. I really hate to say that we have to stop it at this point, because we are being joined by Fran Martino, who is going to be speaking about contaminants in sport fish, another very important issue, not totally unrelated. But I want to thank you both for being here. Buck, if you want to stay on the phone, you can, or I don't know, you may want to run at this point. But thank you so much, Buck Moorhead from NYH2O, a website or a way that people very quickly, that people can get in contact with you, get involved.
Well, NYH2O.org, the Catskill Citizens for Safe Energy, CatskillCitizens.org, UnnaturalGas.org, DamascusCitizens.org are all good. And to answer your second question quickly,
yes,
energy conservation is a way forward. You know, 40% of our energy is used in buildings, and if we can reduce that by 80 to 90%, which they're doing in Europe now and have done in 30,000 buildings since the mid-1990s, check out the Passive House Institute. That's a German group, but there's a U.S. Institute now, and we're working on a project for Habitat for Humanity, which will be one of these Passive House certified buildings in Sullivan County, which will use 80 to 90% less energy for heating and cooling. So that's one of the ways forward amongst the, you know, other renewables.
Well, Buck, you know what? I'd love to have you back on to talk about those alternatives. So we will.
I'd be happy to. Yeah.
Okay, great. We'll be in touch. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yes. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
And we're going to go to a quick musical break, and we will be joined by Fran Martino shortly. And that quick musical break may or may not happen. Let's see. There we go. Little Joni Mitchell with the river, and we're back. This is Christina Malisoff. You're listening to Tell It Like It Is, and I'm very happy to say we are being joined by Fran Martino in studio. And Fran Martino is a self-employed environmental educator and resident of the Village of Philmont. Fran operates a minority women-owned business enterprise known as River Haggy Outdoors. I have to know what a river haggy is. She is an independent contractor who works with Hudson Basin River Watch Incorporated and Cornell Cooperative Extension of Greene County on stream protection for the Stockport Creek and Catskill Creek watersheds. She also educates adults and children about the New York State Department of Health fish consumption advisories. She is here today to share advice from the New York State Department of Health on eating Hudson River fish and fish taken from other waters in the state. And welcome again, Fran.
Thank you, Christina, for having me.
It's a pleasure. So, Fran, just jumping right in, can you first tell us a little bit about your organization and also what is a watershed?
Well, my organization is, you mean my business organization? River Haggy Outdoors?
Yes.
Well, if you're not familiar with the hagfish, I invite you to Google it, look it up. A hagfish is one that can sometimes tie itself into knots, and sometimes in dealing with watershed issues, I feel like I've done just that.
Okay.
But it's an old nickname that was given to me quite a while ago. Today I'm here to talk about the Hudson River Fish Advisories on behalf of the Department of Health. And, you know, as I was listening to Kathy and Buck, I, I kind of thought to myself, I wonder if fracking is going to be the ghost of Christmas future, as I'm talking about the ghost of Christmas past, about things we've done to our water systems to make it impossible to find a meal of fish that is healthy and safe to eat. You know, fishing has been a part of my life for as long as I can remember. I come from an Italian family, and with the Christmas season coming up, the Christmas Eve is just a couple days away, and my mom would be preparing the Feast of the Seven Fishes. We had, you know, anchovy and smelt and the baklava and eels. We would go down the river and collect all of this wonderful fish to have a great feast on Christmas Eve. And I thought to myself, can we do that in today's world? You know, are the fish safe to eat? Every state in the United States has a fish advisory. And New York State is one of them. The advice is based on information that's gathered from the DEC. They go out on a yearly basis and they take samples and they test for the contaminants found in the fish from various water bodies. And, you know, it's important to note that it's not just the Hudson River that has issues. It's tributaries that are not... that don't have dams or barriers to stop the fish from moving. It's lakes up in the Adirondacks. It's Kinderhook Lake over in Columbia County. It's North South Lake up in the Catskills. It's all of our water bodies that have these issues. 90% of all the advisories that were issued in 2010, this is according to the EPA statistics, 90% or 98% of all the advisories involved five particular chemical contaminants. PCBs is one of them, and everybody knows right. Man-made chemicals.
Even in the creeks.
Even in the creeks, exactly. Okay. And even though PCBs were banned back in the 1970s, the effects of PCBs are still out there. And the health concerns include things like birth weight in youngsters, short-term memory problems, learning abilities, the reproductive system in adults. The other thing that the other contaminant that is studied is mercury. Mm. Now, you know, mercury is a naturally occurring metal. It's the only metal out there in liquid form. And the emissions from the coal-burning power plants and cement plants has resulted in our waters being contaminated, which, again, has health concerns that include effects on the nervous system, brain, kidneys, memory function. The other thing is DDTs and myricks and chlordanes. These are man-made chemicals that were used basically for insecticides.
DDTs have been banned since the 60s, but they're still in the environment.
They're banned, but they're still out there.
Persistent. Okay.
Yeah. Dioxins, another byproduct of manufacturing, smoke or ash from vehicles, wastewater incinerators, wood fires, trash burning. All of these things can put dioxins into the environment. And the effects there are problems with liver function, reproduction system. So the fish advisories are something that not enough people know about. And, you know, my family didn't know about it in those days of us collecting eels and collecting fish for our Christmas Eve, you know, feast of fishes. The New York State Department of Health does put out this fish advisory, and they update it as needed. The information can be found on their website, which is www.health.ny.gov/fish. The advice is based on, well, who are you that might be eating the fish? Where did you get the fish from? And what kind of a fish is it? So there's three questions that you need to be asking yourself. Basically, women of childbearing age, and the Department of Health kind of defines that as anybody under the age of 50. And then children under the age of 15 should not eat any of the fish or crabs from the Hudson River in the area of from the Corinth Dam all the way down to the Battery, that whole section of river we should not be eating.
If people don't know what the Battery is, it's New York City Battery Park.
So
talking, I mean, when I go out in the summer and I see so many kids out with their families, a lot of Bangladeshis fishing from the river, migrant workers and their families, I see them fishing and cooking the fish. You're this is something we need to get out to them.
Absolutely. In our section of the river, the Department of Health kind of divides the river into three segments. And our section, they refer to it as the mid-Hudson portion of the river. And so that would be the city of Hudson, all of Columbia County. On the other side, our sister communities in Albany and Greene County on the other side of the river. So from the Troy Dam down to the Rip Van Winkle Bridge is considered mid-Hudson section. And there you need to, those who can eat fish, and that's only women over the age of 50, not childbearing years, and men can eat certain fishes, alewives and blueback herrings, rock bass, yellow perch, but you have to limit your intakes. And by limiting, they're asking or suggesting that it be no more than one meal per month. And a meal is pretty much a small amount. I mean, that's like a half a pound of fish. And there's certain ways that you should be careful about preparing the fish, not pan frying it, but rather grilling it or broiling it or even baking it. So it's important to note, though, that it's not just the Hudson River. There are other water systems that have issues. And all of this information is on the Department of Health's website. There is other information that can be found through the Food and Drug Administration's website, the Environmental Protection Agency's website, and also the National Water Quality Assessment Program's website at www.usgs.gov. There's a free school program that I've been running around communities offering. It can be done as a in-the-classroom program, or it can be an after-school program. There's absolutely no charge to any school system. It's geared for grades K through 6. I've done the entire student population up at Brighter Choice School for Boys and Brighter Choice School for Girls up in Albany, and many of the school districts in Columbia, Greene, Rensselaer, and Albany counties. And I've always said, if you go in and you teach the children, they're going to go home and teach the parents. So if anyone is interested in that free school program, just go ahead and send an email to HRFA, that stands for Hudson River Fish Advisory, HRFA at health.state.ny.us. And we'd be happy to come out and provide the program for the children so that they can go home and teach their parents.
Well, thank you so much. I'd love to have you back on, Fran, to talk more about this and talk more and to keep people updated on this. We're actually running over. For those who are expecting Al Jazeera English, it will be coming up shortly. But in the meantime, we're going to take it out with some music. Again, Fran Martino, thank you so much for coming in this morning and talking about the advisory. And again, where can we get information?
The fish advisory information is on the Department of Health's website, and that is www.nyhealth.gov/fish.
Great. Okay.
Thanks a lot, Christina.
All right. Thank you all. And we're going to take it out of here. And tune in next week. We will be playing the Helen Caldicott talk from 3 weeks ago in its entirety. So we'll see you then. And happy holidays.
WGXC underwriting support provided by Sundog Solar at Solaqua Power and Art, Chatham, New York. Think outside the barrel with solar electric, new solar hot water rebates, and foam and cellulose insulation. SundogSolar.net.
Attention, men and women, 50 and older.
I'm Arnold Nido in Washington with news from
the Cancer Services Program offers free cancer screening tests. You could be eligible for free clinical breast exams, mammograms, pap smears, and colon tests. There are many local doctors to choose from. To find out more, please call the Cancer Services Program at 518-822-8741. Early detection is the best prevention. The Columbia Green Cancer Services Program is a program of the Healthcare Consortium and is funded by the New York State Department of Health Cancer Services Program.
News centers here in Doha and Washington, D.C. These are our top global news stories. Killing on a grand scale, the Syrian military hunts down defectors as the U.S. ups the pressure on Assad.
Iraq's justice system is in crisis.
Staying put, Iraq's vice president tells Al Jazeera he'll not return to Baghdad to face trial.
I'm Arnold Nido in Washington with news from the Americas. The Mexican city of Veracruz fires all of its police officers in an effort to root out corruption. Plus,
I'm Gabriel Elizondo in Sao Paulo, Brazil, where a new study indicates that the number of Brazilians that live in substandard housing has increased almost 75% in the last decade.
Welcome to the News Hour. An advance team of Arab League observers is expected in Syria on Thursday to prepare for a full delegation by the end of the month. But many doubt the mission will bring any end to the violence, with more than 200 people killed in the last 48 hours alone. Instead, activists are taking matters into their own hands, as Zeynep Khoda reports from neighboring Turkey.
In Turkey, Omar al-Akkad relays the demands of dissidents inside Syria to exiled opponents of the government. His mission is to unite a divided opposition that has weakened their cause.
We need a leadership. The revolution has been uncoordinated and disorganized. For it to continue, we need support from outside.
This new opposition group is hoping to do just that. Omar is a member of LIKA, which means alliance.
We said that we are, or we constitute, the majority of the groups, revolutionary and political groups that lead these revolutionary groups in Syria, inside Syria.
In other words, the Syrian street. Local coordinating committees have been largely credited to be the driving force behind the uprising. They want to be recognized.
LIKA was created because the opposition outside and inside Syria doesn't represent the street. They're not listening to what the people want. The committees decided they needed a political body to push for their demands.
Their demands create safe areas for civilians to escape and army defectors to operate. They also want measures that will lead to the government's downfall and not prolong its survival.
LIKA says it is coordinating with the Syrian National Council, the main political opposition. The SNC has been criticized for not being in touch with the reality on the ground. It recently toughened its stance. It called on the UN Security Council to create safe zones, a stance that is more in line with the demands of the protesters.
In the streets, those who continue to confront the state are speaking in one voice. Now they want to make sure it is they who speak for the opposition. Zeynep Khoda, Al Jazeera, Hatay, Southern Turkey.
The Arab League is calling for the violence to stop, and it hopes the observers due in Damascus on Thursday can work towards the goal. It follows a series of attempts by the Arab League to pressure Syria into complying with a peace deal. In November, the Arab League voted to suspend Syria for failing to implement the plan. Weeks later, the League voted to impose sanctions on Bashar al-Assad's government. At the time, Syria described the move as a betrayal of Arab solidarity. But on Monday, Syria agreed to let Arab observers into the country. Their job is to monitor the Arab League proposal to end the violence. Well, meanwhile, international outrage is growing. The UN Security Council is urging Russia to act quickly on a resolution to condemn the violence. France has described the latest violence as a massacre of unprecedented proportions. And Turkey says the Syrian government's actions are unacceptable. The US says the events of the past 2 days have been deeply disturbing. It's again calling on Syria's president to step down.
And it's clear that every metric shows the situation is moving against Assad. Defections of the military are on the rise. Diplomats have begun leaving their posts and coming out in support of the Syrian opposition. The opposition is more unified, more inclusive. The regime has been cut off by the Arab League, by its traditional allies and neighbors like Turkey. And the regime is under increasing financial duress, due to international sanctions and weak domestic economic policies. It is only a matter of time before this regime comes to an end. Only fear is holding it together.
Well, earlier I spoke to Chris Doyle from the Council for Arab-British Understanding. He said Russia is protecting its own interests by refusing to condemn the Syrian government.
Well, Russia knows precisely what's going on in Syria. Let's not kid ourselves. It has a historic relationship, a military and economic one. It has vested interests, and it does not want to see Syria out of its orbit. It wants to have its naval base at Tartus and its various other economic interests looked after. So it's going to make a very careful calculation as to whether it actually is going to backfire on it, if this regime is definitely leaving power in any event. Perhaps it needs to encourage relationships with other Syrian groupings. But right at this moment, Russia is crucial. It's likely that China would follow whatever Russia sets as the